with a statement that it's probably a representation of a limiting case when series goes into observations for this conference. But after Wei Li talked about instrumentation, I cannot actually make that claim anymore. So Jim a little bit built up my confidence that not all theorists in cosmology are actually doing observation nowadays. Anyway, so even if you still take this kind of asymptotical process to be involved in observations, two features usually arise. First of all, you acquire typically a long list of authors, and many of whom you maybe even didn't meet. And secondly, formulas start to disappear from your presentation. So there will be no formulas further on. So when astrophysicists speak about metals, they speak about any elements heavier than the helium. And in the mid-90s, what has been discovered, those are metal absorption lines in the spectra of quasars in the regions which are outside of the galaxy. So extragalactic metals have been discovered. That is kind of a very important fact, because metals have to be ejected from the in some energetic processes, either from star-forming regions or from early galaxies, to actually pollute extragalactic metals. And such energetic processes have a big implication both for physics of the high redshift universe, but also kind of on the properties of the intergalactic medium as well. For example, the same type energetic processes can kind of destroy the blue up baryons from the dwarf galaxy and inhibit dwarf galaxy formation. On the other side, presence of the metals around provides usually an efficient mechanism for the cooling, and that can help late time galaxy formation, for example, as well. So since then, a lot of new data has been acquired since the mid-90s. And in particular, we learned that if you count kind of the density of the metals, that's actually about carbon-4, which would be one of the important ionization species of the carbon, which will be discussed, important type of lights, lines, that the amount of the metals in through redshift is actually pretty constant from redshift 5 to our day. So in essence, most of them have been polluted, have been thrown into the galactic medium, perhaps before redshift 5. On the other hand, although there is a constancy in redshift, there is no such constancy in space. Amount of metals in, along different line of sight to different quasars is quite non-uniform, and there are kind of fluctuations by an order of magnitude from place to place. So if you remember the talk by Maxim Pospelov yesterday, he was discussing search for lithium-6 in a metal-poor areas of our universe. So in this sense, indirectly, understanding metal distribution is important to placing, for example, limits on the trace elements of the light elements from Big Bang near citizens. You want to find the regions which are kind of quiescent and not polluted that much for that problem. So, right. So this non-uniformity of the distribution of metal in space is kind of main subject of my talk or for our work, which we have done in a rather large collaboration. In essence, we put a goal using some data set. And of course, such type of theoretical work is always motivated by the fact that you have a good data set, new one. So we want to study the clustering of the metal lines in a special clustering of the metal lines in a quasar spectra, in a set of quasar spectra, and with a goal to essentially learn something about the properties of the sources of those metals, of the centers of the pollution of our universe. So in principle, there are kind of several competing scenarios what could be the sources of the pollution, going from the reasonably late time starburst galaxies, which would probably pollute a neighborhood around them at redshift 3 or 4, maybe up to the 6. And there is really a quite significant correlations of the carbon distribution with the starburst galaxies. But perhaps it is an earlier structures, actually progenitors of a big galaxies at a higher redshift, at a redshift larger than 6, say 7, 8, perhaps 8, or maybe as a crude kind of split first type of stars, first stars which formed in the beginning of the kind of structure formation at a higher redshift. Probably after WMAP 3, you should not put this first star formation now to redshift 20. Maybe it moved to a lower redshift. So different scenarios will give different special structure of the metal distribution, and at some level, studying correlation properties, perhaps a handle to distinguish between them. So I actually cannot say that we have succeeded to distinguish between them, but we did kind of some step towards this direction. So our data set has European origin as part of the ESA program at VLT. So I was not involved in taking the data. So this is a sample spectra of a quasar along one line of sight. And we are looking at the frequency range. You see it is all in French. So we're looking at the frequency range longer than the Lyman alpha line and say up to carbon-4 emission line. And all those absorption lines are where we, the metals have been searched for. There's a big part of a project which was devoted to developing automated technique for determining those lines. Christoph Pichon was with a student an important kind of driver behind this project. So the wavelengths which are plotted here is the wavelengths as we are observed, and the properties of the telescope essentially tells you at what redshifts you can detect those lines. And our main kind of species we'll be talking about is carbon and silicon, which is pretty similar. And those we can detect at the redshift like 1.5 to 3. And at a closer redshift, we can detect magnesium 2 and ferrum 2 lines. So they have a bit longer wavelengths. All right. So those our targets, target species like different environments. So the curves which are here tells you a fraction of the suitably analyzed ionized species to the hydrogen one, and as a function of amount or density of the hydrogen, density in the baryons, and different lines corresponds to different temperatures. And with an increase of temperature, amount of species goes down because they're getting destroyed at high species, at high temperatures. So carbon traces for us, right, so that's too many. Carbon likes moderately overdense region, delta 10 or maybe 30, and reasonably resistant to the temperature. So about 10 to the 5, it will be destroyed. Below, probably, it will survive in a reasonable amount. So the other guys are all like denser and denser regions, so more and more concentrated ones, and more susceptible to the kind of destruction at high temperatures. So in this sense, for example, the iron really lives in a very dense and very cold places. So this is, so we have some amount of lines being determined, which are associated with those concentrated objects of which contains metals. There are several quasar lines, something like 19, which we had. And in those spectra, we determined around 600 carbon lines and around, well, there's a little bit 300 magnesium and 80 silicon and iron. So what is important? So on that plot, we plot actually number of objects of a fixed column density, and there is some cut on a low bound at around 10 to the 12 atoms per centimeter square, and on the upper side 10 to the 15. So it fits pretty well by the power law, but that's not what's important for me. What is important is that when we split our sample into redshifts, then there is essentially no change. So there is actually really one more indication that there is no evolution in the number of this dense metal objects, similar to what I have shown on one of the first slides. And that is valid both for all the species. So, well, for the kind of iron, the data is a bit less certain. And those two species, magnesium and iron, are on a lower redshift. And those guys are on a high redshift. So it really looks like that the evolution of the object at redshift 3 and below is already pretty passive. They already formed, they're already there. Now, kind of our main measured piece is a correlation function. And so correlation function is quite interesting. So let's look at the carbon line. So again, we have a split into redshifts. So we see a little bit of the evolution of the correlation function. I'll tell it in a second about that. But what is important is that the amplitude of the correlation is pretty high. So that's one important, it's much higher than the correlation of the underlying density in homogeneities. It also, if you look carefully, kind of you can distinguish two regimes with a break at something like 150 kilometers a second. There is a tail, reasonably high tail, but decrease in one. And then there is a break, and it goes into plateau at a lower separation. So that's, at some level, the features which you want to reproduce in a model. So silicon on this plot is not very kind of, well, good, but not as impressive. We did several tests, kind of checking how robust our measurements, changing cutoffs in the column densities up and down, some relinking of the objects, and it is pretty robust. It actually stays there. So yeah, let me return for a second on this evolution. I'll go one way up. So actually, it is quite similar for the magnesium and iron, and that is the final plot where all four of them are here. So on the bottom there is our carbon and silicon traces carbon very well. There is very little difference in spatial distribution, and my collaborators put an argument that it is an argument in favor of not. That is really inhomogeneity in the distribution of the species and not of ionizing flux, because it have a little bit different ionization level, silicon and carbon. Right. The amplitude of the late redshift, well, lower redshift stuff is higher, but which you remember is pretty much the same which I had for carbon. So the step in the amplitude increase when you go to lower redshift. And it's surprising, it's actually practically fit very well by just linear evolution of the clustering. And in some sense, again, it is kind of towards a picture of the passive evolution of already formed objects. They continue to cluster further on. Right, how much time do we have? 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Right, so one part of our work was to use hydrodynamical simulation of Hugh Couchman and Tucker here nearby at McMaster to actually produce simulated spectra and try to fit the model parameters to the observed correlation properties. So this is a quick sketch what has been done, and I'm not going in detail of all the step of synthetic spectra production in the 3 minutes. But what is important is that the first try, what we did, we tried to produce kind of a continuous field of a distribution of the carbon under assumption of a kind of constant metallicity or metallicity which tracks the local density. So you then have to run a code, something like Claudy, which would run all the chains of, well, it would take your ionizing flux, temperature distribution, et cetera, and gives a list of different species. But again, so that is a try when metallicity is actually just follows the density linearly or non-linearly. And that doesn't work. So what you always get is significantly low amplitude of the correlation. You may play with parameters to fit the number of objects, but correlations is just way too low. And that is, of course, a signature that you deal with some biased process, that in reality, your metal lines are concentrated around some rare objects of some correlated process. And rare objects of the correlated process, as we know, are biased in a way that they're correlated more than the field itself. And a simple story gives the correlation right. So if we assume that we have correlated between themselves but discrete pollution centers, which polluted only some bubbles around them with a metal, then if you associate these centers with some rare galaxies, or kind of, you don't need rare galaxies at redshift 3. You need things which are correlated similar to the rare peaks of the Gaussian field, if you like. Then you end up with a highly biased process, which actually does describe both the tail and the amplitude of the correlation field. So the parameters would be the rarity, what objects do you pick as a pollution center, and that's what mostly will determine your correlation, but also the distribution of, well, the sizes of your bubbles. And sizes of the bubbles relates to the energetics of the event, and you, in principle, can link the two. Right, so that's a set of different stuff, and among them, there are successful fits of the correlation function, with objects should be at redshift 3 as rare as 10 to the 12 galaxy at redshift 3. And bubbles are pretty large. They're up to 2 megaparsecs. So it has to be pretty energetic events which could throw metal so far. Those are comoving ones. And at the end, that was all good. But here where theory comes is that you can actually build an analytic model for that, or you can actually calculate this correlation analytically to some extent. And the picture, actually, which we did try to calculate for is that, of course, metals are not produced at redshift 3, but metals produced earlier at redshift like 7.5 in a rare objects, rare large, what is large for that time galaxies, up to 10 to the 9 solar masses. That's large at redshift 7.5. And then kind of the bubbles were spreading around up to redshift 3, and at redshift 3 is what we are seeing at. So actually, I would like you to look at the left plot, at the right plot, and not at the left one. Indeed, the lines, the curves which were obtained more or less match the data. I actually didn't play that much with the parameter to try to achieve the great match. The tail is, of course, a correlation between themselves of the of those pollution centers of rare events. I did a little bit more. I actually compute 4-point correlation function of the exertion in the Gaussian field. If the tail, which is determined by the correlation of the pollution center, is more like essentially Kaiser formula. It goes into the Kaiser formula. But you can get a pretty uniform approximation which actually describes both the tail of the pollution center distribution and when they start overlapping as well. So it was a little bit fun of integrating. And that's what theoretical work is. So I'll stop here, and I will just would like to tell once again that the data on the metal lines, well, it's of course not of a precision of the CMB field yet. but it reflects an important aspect of high redshift life of our universe, and the clustering properties of metals are related to what was the source of those metals. And we'll probably provide a link and some hints to distinguish between different models of metal enrichment of intergalactic medium. Thanks.